Welcome to the session on foundations. We'll get right started here, since a lot of people have a lot of things to say. First, Peter Johansson.
Hi.
Thanks. So I'm not a magician. My background is philosophy and cognitive science. But we've used magic as a tool to study various aspects of cognition and self-knowledge. And so if there's time, I'd like to present two short experiments, and then we can discuss what that means for this conference. I'll start off with showing you a short movie introducing the approach.
But there's another problem. These men have discovered that sometimes your brain appears to conspire against you, and no amount of scribbling can solve that. Petter Johansson is forcing people to make decisions. It's a simple enough task for most people, and in fact, it isn't the real point of the experiment.
Why do you prefer that role?
High cheekbones, slightly better hair, not much cooler.
Petter Johansson and Lars Hall have devised an experiment which calls into question many of our assumptions about how we make most of our everyday decisions.
We're interested to see what kind of detail the representations behind people's decisions and what kind of insight they have about those decisions.
What made you choose this one?
It seems like he's got a very interesting personality.
This is all quite boring until you look at the experiment from a different perspective.
We added a twist, a card trick, so that sometimes they choose one face but end up with the other one.
Watch carefully. The volunteer chooses the card on the left, but Petter swaps the card and presents the photo that was seen on the right and was actually rejected.
It is a card trick, but it's a cheap card trick, based on something that the magicians call black on black. So for each card, there's a hidden card behind it, which is actually the opposite one. When we slide the other card over, the black card is hidden. And then Petter just uses his arm to slide down into his lap.
I mean, it's two parts that's interesting me. First, the fact that they don't notice when you switch the pictures is interesting in itself and it's quite surprising. And the second part is, of course, the verbal reports they give, but they actually motivate choices they didn't make.
80% of the people we tested have absolutely no idea that a switch has been made.
Again, this sort of struck me. Interesting shot. Since I'm a photographer, I like the way it's lit and looks.
It's a puzzle.
All right.
How hard to keep a straight face there when you're...
It was a little bit hard sometimes. I guess you got the manipulation. So we switched the card, present the other one. Yes, to show that we also did a proper study on this and to show that the faces presented were actually quite dissimilar. So we had them two different groups, one with rather similar faces, one with quite actually dissimilar faces. For each participant, we did three of these manipulations. And it turns out, as in the video, the video was done with naive participants, although I had no idea what this was going to happen. And if you do this with real participants, with these stimulus, that quite low percentage is actually detected. So if you look at this graph, these would be concurrent detected when they immediately say something is wrong. The other is retrospective detection, when you in the debriefing session get a hint that something is wrong. And the two graphs here represent that if they detect a detection in the beginning, one of the two of the three trials, they're more likely to detect subsequent ones. So this kind of works. What was more interesting, they also analyzed all the reports people gave for these manipulated choices. And we also used a lot of the tools for lie detection that presented in morning, Penn and Baker's, and these type of linguistic analysis, also later semantic analysis, and a lot of different stuff to see if there are any differences when people then confabulated reasons or when they gave true reasons. We found very, very few differences between them. So it looks like it's more or less the same process in both of these cases. And perhaps even more interestingly, we then matched what they were saying with the pictures. So remember the logic of the experiments. So in this case, they preferred this face, but ended up with this one. And this male participant said, "She's radiant. I would rather have approached her at the bar than the other one. I like the earrings." Which then can't have been the real reason for preferring this face, because the one he preferred didn't have any earrings. So we've been using this approach to study self-knowledge, because that's my main interest, to see what people say when you can manipulate their choices. And we've done it in a number of different contexts, for different stimuli, for different things. And I'll just show one thing here that you might find interesting. The reason why we started doing this with hands-on magic rather than on a computer screen, which is a normal procedure when you do psychological experiment, is that you actually get a much lower detection rate when you do this by hand. People trust the physical world to stay constant. In a digital environment, anything can happen, things go wrong, things change, and you expect it. Things in the real world don't change in unnoticeable ways. We're a bit short of time, but I'd like to show you one more of our experiments, because you might find it a bit amusing. So why is this? Right. So in this, we have built a magical questionnaire. So try to figure out what the trick is this time. So here there are moral statements here of the like, the violence conducted by the Israeli in the conflict with Hamas was morally reprehensible due to the civilian casualties. To what extent do you agree or disagree with this statement? And then they fill in their answers. They answer some fillers, like how hard you think this experiment was. This guy just writes his name on it. And age and gender. And then we close the questionnaire and then say, right, I'd like to ask you a few follow-up questions and discuss what you did, how you answered what you thought. This time, the questions have changed, because the original questions were written on a glued-on piece of paper that was here. So when the participants answer, when I ask them to sort of follow up and explain, they're actually answering the opposite of the question, the negation of the question. Right. So here you can see, here's an example of when we've changed for, it's more important for a site to promote the welfare of the citizens rather than protect their personal integrity. We then change it to protect the personal integrity rather than the welfare. And it turns out that you get quite similar detection rate in these experiments as well. We've done it with two different conditions, one with abstract moral principles, one with concrete statements. These are then detection rates for different questions, and also showing you can what they actually say in relation to these different questions. So a very large proportion of the people not detecting the manipulation are also willing to give quite good and strong arguments going in the opposite direction. And we thought, okay, this might work for the abstract principle, but it will not work at all for when there's real concrete issues. But it turns out that you get more or less the same detection rate and levels of confabulation for these very concrete, very specific statements. And I'll just show you an example, 1 minute left. So I'll show you one, we'll do it in English instead of Swedish. So here's an example of a confabulation made by one of the participants. So remember that he was faced with the reversal of this question. So when he answered it, he did actually think that you shouldn't be able to do mass surveillance. So we asked them, yes, so you think this should be allowed? How did you reason here? Well, like, as it's so hard to get international crime and terrorism, I think there should be those kinds of tools. Like, and then he remembers an example from today's paper that actually backs up his claim. And then he goes on to strongly say it's madness that we don't have the powers to do this. And then, yeah, the construction in Swedish is very strong. It says it is madness. And then in the end, there is a brief back and forth saying, well, in the long run, well, we shouldn't be able to do all of this kind of threatening for our privacy. But in the long run, I think it's worth it. Which means, even for these detailed of real issues, people are willing to do these kind of confabulary statements. I, from my perspective, I guess there are a number of different issues that connect to what people are doing here at the conference. So I guess one is that people don't know, the fact that people don't know themselves more than this is something people can use when they scam. You can press people into saying things and then they endorse and stay with this statement, which is what scammers often do then. It's interesting here when everybody discusses email and internet traffic, it actually, if you want to con someone, if you use physical means, it might even get stronger. And just that my final thought on this was, perhaps maybe you can use this choice minus type research as a tool to detect deception. If you say in, like, fraud, insurance fraud is a big thing when people exaggerate their injuries and claims, but maybe if you confront them with sort of switching their statement to something else, they will respond differently. If sort of the internal representation of the fraud or the intent to deceive is different from the real memory, they might then react to these differently and detect all of the switches because it's so salient in the memory. Right, so that was 10 minutes. There's 15 minutes and 10 minutes. So then you switch on.
Next we have Michelle Batten.
So how do you switch over to the PC?
Switching to...
Yes, switching to the PC.
I'm just going to talk.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'm an economist specializing in behavioral economics. And what I've done with the various papers that were put online is have a look at them and draw out some of the key economic themes that seem to be surfacing. And starting to link that with some of the things that I'm doing in my own research. And most recently, I've been doing some neuroeconomic research with Wolfram Schultz. Obviously, there's a wide range of issues that have been addressed in all those papers online, and so I have sort of written a summary, very rough paper, sort of putting together some of these ideas with the economic theory. But what I'm going to start with thinking about is firstly why people behave in the way that they might behave. Specifically, why might they not be making the efforts they should be making to protect security and privacy? So why? And then possibly the more interesting question is what to do about it. Now, in terms of economic theory, you can explain some of the problems, as some of the papers have done online, you can explain why you've got problems in this area in terms of a market model based in orthodox economics, which assumes specific types of market failure. So externalities, network externalities being a key one. One theme that could be developed in there, which we won't go into in too much depth, but could possibly be interesting, is the idea of security as a public good. Now, public goods have characteristics that some of their benefits are accessible to everyone. It's difficult to stop other people from using the benefits of other people's security protection, for example. So I think that's one interesting theme to develop within that area. But from my point of view, I'm more interested in models of economics, which start to relax some of the very strict rationality assumptions that mainstream economics makes. Now, one of the ways to understand, conceptualize this quite clearly is to look to Herbert Simon's ideas. So some of you will be aware of Herbert Simon's idea of bounded rationality, so that people's behavior is limited by the fact that information isn't fully and readily available, and or limited by cognitive limitations. They're not maybe very able to process the information in the way that they need to do so. And in, within this theme, if, Herbert Simon also makes a distinction between what he calls substantive rationality and procedural rationality. Now, in substantive rationality, people might be boundedly rational in the sense that they don't have access to full information about what they're doing, what other people are doing. But nonetheless, they're using some sort of algorithm, some sort of mathematical rule to make their decision. So essentially, in a substantive view, people are mathematical machines. Now, in strict orthodox theory, this involves maximization, constrained optimization problems, a whole series of them. But we can relax that again, and a question before, talking about the Bayesian approach, you can say, well, Bayes' rule is a mathematical algorithm people are using in a systematic mathematical way as if they were a machine. In this, I mean, obviously putting ideas into structure and boxes is hostage to fortune in a sense, but in this sense, I think that models which or ideas which focus in on asymmetric information, so there are a few ideas within the papers, particularly from Ross and Tyler Moore, ideas of asymmetric information, you can understand those in terms of substantive rationality. People are looking at the fact that the information isn't complete. Someone knows more about the situation than they do, but nonetheless they respond to it in a mathematical way. And so there obviously is enormous literature on asymmetric information. The two key types of problems, adverse selection, which is a problem of hidden information, you don't know what someone's trying to sell you. So adverse selection is obviously going to be a key problem when people are dealing with online commerce or whatever. But the models that you see in the economic literature are addressing this issue using mathematical techniques, assuming people are behaving like mathematical machines. The other key problem that I guess got less emphasis but is similarly important is the problem of moral hazard, which is a problem of hidden action. And so, of course, this is going to have implications if people are promising to do something that they later, once a contract is signed, let's say, that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, some of the I noticed another theme that was coming in some of the papers was the idea of teams and team effort. And if you've got a team working together, you've got this moral hazard problem because not every... people are going to free ride on the efforts of others within the team. And so that's going to have implications if people are collaborating, say, in providing security products or whatever. But all of this asymmetric information, these problems can be understood and are analysed by numerous economists in terms of a substantively rational approach. People are dealing with the issue mathematically. What's more interesting, and I guess more cutting edge, is the growing recognition in economics that people are not substantively rational, maybe they're procedurally rational. So procedurally rational is appropriate deliberation. They're doing the best they can in the circumstances. They're using the information in a sort of fuzzy way. They're not using maths to do it. And so in this sense, what you start to get into the Kahneman and Tversky literature on heuristics and biases. So all the sorts of biases that you see people... the mistakes they make, but maybe they make them because they're boundedly rational rather than because they're stupid. And so you've got a whole literature there. Some of you might have read the Thaler and Sunstein book, Quite Accessible, Nudge, that's starting to get into some of these issues. And obviously, Richard Thaler has done a big analysis of all these sorts of things. He's coined the term quasi-rational economics, that people aren't strictly mathematically rational, but they're still doing things in quite sensible ways. So you could discuss for hours whether it's rational or not rational. But I think there's a whole range of biases in there. One of the most interesting and important biases, I think, and when you're sort of building up a policy argument or policy solutions, is present bias. Now, there's a growing literature in economics on present bias, analysed in a range of different ways. But present bias links into all the ideas about procrastination. You know you should go to the gym, you want to get fit, and so you sign up for the gym, but you never go. So there's been some experimental research demonstrating this is what happens. People spend a lot more money on year-long gym memberships when if they just paid per visit, they would save themselves some money and had no, same outcome in terms of their fitness. And so there is this very interesting literature on procrastination. And what you can understand the way and why and how people procrastinate just by looking at their discount functions, how they judge the future. And by making a little tweak to those discount functions, by introducing the idea that people suffer from something called a present bias. They're disproportionately impatient, if you like. They suffer from this present bias, and this means they change their mind. They suffer from time inconsistency. They get preference reversals over time, which is very difficult to explain in terms of standard economics. So I think that's a really interesting theme on the whole. Some other work I'm doing on household energy consumption is also this idea that people procrastinate. So procrastination for privacy and security or whatever, people intend to do something to sort themselves out, but they don't ever quite get around to it because they procrastinate. No, I'll sort it out next week, but I'm not going to sort it out now. I really want to buy that thing now. I don't want to wait. So this is sort of getting into psychology. Another very interesting area, and the one that I'm increasingly interested in, is some of the sociological things that might be going on. So in terms of sociology, the two aspects, which links nicely into the hypnotism bit before, two aspects, I guess, from a socioeconomic point of view. One is the sort of normative influence, the peer pressure. People do what other people are doing because other people are doing it. The other is a social learning idea, so an informational influence. And the informational influence you can, to an extent, I guess, understand using Bayesian sorts of ideas, but it's that you learn from others. You learn that something is broken, you know, that a cash machine is broken because there's no queue there. So people before you have decided not to use that machine, there must be a reason for it. And you're sort of learning from the behaviour of others. And, you know, in evolutionary biology, it's quite demonstrable that animals, humans, learn from the behaviour of others. Social influence in policy terms, when we start to think about what to do about it, for a lot of things like spam phishing, the costs on the criminal of the crime are very, very small. And so how are you going to put together, one of the papers I think was talking about strategy-proof design, how are you going to put together a strategy-proof design when the costs to the perpetrators are so very, very small? Which suggests you've got two choices, either to get individuals to be responsible for themselves somehow, but they're going to procrastinate, or you get government regulation in there. But given the sort of ubiquity of the internet, the complexity, the fact that it's completely globalised, how are governments going to regulate it? That's going to be a very difficult task. And so maybe the solution is to start to get people to take responsibility for their own privacy and security, but they procrastinate. One way to do it is via the social influence. People do what others are doing. And what the hypnotism ideas are saying, that people will do what others are doing. It's also been established again in the literature, there's been an experiment done on household energy consumption, people being told about what their neighbours are doing, and it does affect their decisions. They become more responsible in their energy use because their neighbours or whatever are setting good examples. And so there's some of the policy issues to think about there. But increasingly, economists are recognising that it's not all about humans as mathematical machines using a substantively rational approach. And any sort of effective policy design is going to have to take into account these socio-psychological factors. And an increasing and very, very interesting literature in experimental economics and neuroeconomics as well that's starting to explore some of these issues.
Thank you very much, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I'm really speaking on behalf of 15 people, so I'm going to use the word we. So, trust me, I need your empathy so that you know that I'm not lying. And I'm grateful to Rafe Zagarin, who he and I really sort of began the project together. But we have one other of the 15. If you need verification, Scott Atran is over here. He's part of our 15. And our latest idea, as I say at the beginning, so I forget, is in a Nature article in Nature of 20th of May. I got a few off prints, but only a handful in Nature are very mean. And so you can look there if you, because I'm going to talk fast to get in my 10 minutes. People already mentioned Darwin. We had a mention of Dawkins and others, so my talk is all about adaptation. But looking back in the 3.5 billion years of the evolution of life in some form or another, out of that 3.5 billion years, humans have been around 0.04% of the time. So I think it behoves us to go right the way back to see what we can learn from it. If you're looking at this slide, from the bottom left-hand corner, that's 9/11. This is about responding rather than adapting. Okay, so after 9/11, there were all the more rigorous searches carried out. Cockpit doors were locked. And then we had Richard Reed with the shoe bomber. And then we had to take our shoes off and so on, responding. And then we had that group who had a plan. Fortunately, it didn't come off. With carrying liquids that could be blended, and then we had the liquid thing, baby milk problems and all this stuff, till we get forward to the Christmas bomber taking powder and mixing that and so on. So it's a history in this particular case of response after the event, and you have to think very hard about the long-term value of doing this. But in the natural world, adaptation, you could say, was driven by urgency, having to change. And there has to be an opportunity, or there won't be any adaptation. So there's our friend, the reptile, coming out of the water. In the sort of response mode that I was describing earlier on, you develop what some people have described as an ecology of peer. You see the Jersey barriers going up. This is Washington, D.C., for those who are not familiar. I'm sure most of you are. And so around you, the lady wearing the emergency hood to put on. So this ecology of fear builds up. But it's all well described. And people who are trying to do bad things, everything's predictable for them. This is just a quick illustration of all the disciplines that we have in our group. We're more than the 15. Last week, we're at Edinburgh University. We had a lot more people with us from the military, actually, people from the front line in Afghanistan. But those are the disciplines, anything from paleobiology right through to network science, and it's a very exciting project. And that's the photograph is the meeting of our first group, first meeting we had in Santa Barbara. Perhaps not an apt title, but I think it's appropriate, the rules of engagement. Everything is variable. Risk cannot be eliminated, so we have to learn to live with risk. It's all about living with risk. That's a real challenge for politicians who have to explain things to the public and say we've removed that terrorism risk, or maybe it's an economic one or whatever. Nature isn't perfect. It doesn't come up with perfect solutions, and that's actually a strength, which I hope to illustrate later. And, of course, we're not talking about a directed evolution. Nature is not a person. It doesn't plan. So but there's a lot of redundancy and opportunities are created. And the natural solutions are for a specific purpose often, and it's recursive, it's constant learning the whole time. The feedback is going on the whole time. So it's, natural solutions evolve many times over and appear everywhere. You see in the bottom right-hand corner the eye, which appears in many different forms and many different organisms. Just think about that for a moment. So there's all sorts of opportunities are being pursued all the time. Now, how is it done? So, adaptation. We can organize to be adaptable, and we can turn uncertainty into an advantage. You know, in the banking community, risk is good. They make the money out of risk. If there wasn't any risk, they wouldn't make any money. So you can turn risk to an advantage. Learn through a process of selection and use symbiosis to stretch the, to be more elastic about the adaptability. So I'm just going to say a few brief words about each of those. Organization, and that's a picture of Gerard Vermey, one of our 15, who's a paleontologist at UC Davis. By the way, he's been blind since the age of 3, and he does all his work by touch. It's amazing. But his statement in the chapter in our book, Natural Security, he argues that semi-autonomous parts under a weak central control. I'm not sure about the word weak myself, but I think it's a central control that's evolved and has taken decisions which has resulted in success.
I'm not sure weak is
my view anyway, that's just my humble view, is not perhaps the right word, but does result in flexible and adaptable rather means of making responding to unpredictable challenges. And from that, just a thought that always comes up in my head, that the periphery is the area which brings about change. As long as it has some autonomous method of changing, the changes come from the periphery and not from the center. So that would be a point to make. So let's look briefly at organization first then. On the left, and I'm afraid I'm not going to go into the detail, but I'm sure we can explore this later. The immune system is one example. You're not controlling your immune system consciously. It's happening, and it's challenged at the periphery, and it responds. Sometimes it over-responds, and there are various reasons for that, but the normal process is it responds, and it's adapting. The immune system is changing itself all the time, and so it's self-immunizing as you go along. See the octopus there in the middle, which changes color in accordance with its surroundings. Quite a whole range of variety of colors, that particular octopus, but it's being done by parts of its system responding, and it's not making a conscious decision in itself. And then there are colonies, groups of organisms responding collectively on the right-hand end, and then you could think about a whole ecosystem that very complex network just shows how complicated it is. But it wouldn't work unless there was a high degree of decentralization and delegation. And we need to learn from this. So these are just natural systems. Let's look at the 9/11, the first post-9/11 test of homeland security. And the question at the bottom, for those who are not familiar, that's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Where is FEMA? Well, let's look at it organizationally first. There's the Department of Homeland Security, created in response to 9/11. I know you can't read it, but where is FEMA? Can anyone see it on the diagram? No, because that's where it is. Okay, embedded right down in there. On the right-hand side, that's the White House, and under him, the Secretary. And then you switch. It's very hard to get the whole thing on one place. And you've got things like the U.S. Customs, you have the Coast Guard, all that in there. Is this a good idea? This is contrary to what nature is telling us. So we have to think about this a little bit. I'm being a little bit simplistic. Again, on organization, I'm not going to go into the various areas along the top. I'll just mention the one on the right-hand side by Jean-François Richard. Excellent book, if you haven't read it, you should look at it. And he argues that networks are, you know, the key to change, and not the center, but networks. The Google Flu Trends chart is an interesting one. The WHO, which is the yellow line along there, those predictions came, or those that data came out about a week after the event of reports. So the Google Flu Trends, just monitoring reports in the press, took 2 days. But came up, as you can see, pretty close to the more considered results. So there is a way of getting ahead and change. Uncertainty is exploited by a number of organisms. The simplest one is bird flocking. Birds, you only have to be as fast as most of the rest of your community. It's the slow ones that get caught. You don't have to be faster than the animal that's trying to catch you. The cicadas there. Appearing in cardinal years 7, 13, and so on. So that's an interesting one. You see the orca coming out, who's building uncertainty in its favor, coming out of a wave and grabbing a sea lion and pulling it out. So using uncertainty. I think am I at my time?
Yes.
Okay. So I think I've demonstrated the idea between what I would say is decentralize, adapt, and cooperate. So that's the essential idea that we're trying to put out. Thank you very much.
Next we have Will Griffiths. Oh, all right, Griffiths.
Thank you.
So I'm at Michigan State right now, but this is work done while I was at University of Michigan. And in general, a lot of my work looks at motivations and why people are making the choices that they do. And one of the things that I really was really interested in looking at is normal home computer users, people like my mom who sit down at their home and have to use their computer and have to administer the computer, how do they make the security choices about how to use the computer, what security software to run, things like that. So I went out and I actually started talking to a lot of these people. I did a series of interviews of regular home computer users to try to understand how it is that they think about what are the security problems that they face, and therefore, how do they use that information to reason about computer security and make these decisions? So in talking to them, one of the things that I found is that they basically separated everything, all the security problems, into two big categories. What they called viruses, which is just any kind of bad software, and what they called hackers, which are bad people. Big words, yes. So I'll start by talking about what they talked about as viruses. They're actually, when I looked through it, different people had different ideas for what viruses are. There was not one kind of agreed upon idea of virus. I found, what I was looking at, four different ways that people talked about viruses. One of them is that viruses are just kind of generically bad software. I don't know much about them, I just know that they're bad and they obviously do bad things. One group of people talked about viruses as buggy software. These are software with intentional bugs. One group has talked about viruses as programs that are designed to cause mischief. These are like teenagers out causing mischief around town. Viruses are the same thing on computers. And finally, viruses are software intended to support criminals. So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail on two of these real quick. First one is viruses are buggy software. So the basic idea behind this is that software has bugs. Everyone experiences bugs. Programs crash, you click and nothing happens. All software has bugs. Viruses are just worse versions of this. So it's the same bugs. When people think about viruses, these people think about viruses, they think about the same bugs that you would see in normal software, except 10 times worse. It crashes at the most inopportune time rather than crashing randomly. Because of this, they think of this as viruses as regular software, and like most software, you have to download it and run it, or stick a CD in your computer and run it. It's not something that actually just happens to your computer. So they think that these viruses that are buggy software have to be intentionally downloaded and run. And if you just never download and run anything from the internet, then you're safe from viruses. And these are generally created by a group of bad people, and they generally haven't thought about who they are other than that they're bad. A different way of thinking about viruses is that viruses cause mischief. This is the mischievous teenager idea. So they're created by mischievous teenagers, the same kind of mischievous teenagers you see running around town that are really annoying, except these are teenagers with technical skills. They're highly skilled computer people, but they're still mischievous teenagers. These are viruses, in this case, are software that's intended to cause annoying problems. People talked about how one time they had a virus that popped up a skull and crossbones on their computer, and this was annoying. One guy talked about viruses that cause porn pop-ups on their computer. These are annoying problems that people think are attributed to viruses. And you catch these kind of annoying things by visiting shady websites and opening shady emails.
It's like elves.
Yeah. So it's really, they look at this and they see the shady things, they make this connection between the mischievous, annoying teenagers and these shady places on the internet. So this is their idea of what viruses are. One of the really interesting things was when I started looking through various expert security advice, basic security advice like use antivirus software, run a regular antivirus scan, take care and be careful what you download, what websites you go to, and take care of where you go download. Each of these different ideas of what viruses are have very different ideas of how you should protect yourself. So comparing these two, the buggy software and mischief, they have a really different idea of whether you should use antivirus software or not. People who think viruses are just buggy software think antivirus software is roughly unnecessary. I don't go down and download these bad programs, so why would I need antivirus software to protect myself? Whereas people who think viruses are mischievous teenagers who are installing this on your computer against your will, they can see the value of antivirus software, and they're more likely to actually use it. They also think, though, that most of it comes from shady websites, so if I avoid like the porn and the pop-up laden websites on the internet, I don't really need it, but I can see the value in it. So there's big differences on across all four of these different categories of virus models on how they react to this very standard, very basic security software, security advice. The other category is hackers, bad people. These are how do they think of bad people? And again, there were these four different models that emerged. It just happened before. It didn't, wasn't imposed on that. One of them, hackers are what I call digital graffiti artists, which is very similar to the mischievous teenager idea. Hackers are these mischievous teenagers that go into, they break into your computer and cause mischief. Second one is hackers are burglars. This is looking at the standard idea of a burglar and importing that into the digital realm. Hackers break into computers and look around your stuff and try to find something that they want. There's this very closely related one called that I call hackers target big fish, which has to do with how burglars decide to choose who they target. And then finally, hackers are contractors to criminals. And then this last one is the idea that basically there's this organized crime out there that's really bad, and hackers are out there to help them do what they do. So again, I'm going to go into this, two of them in a little bit more detail. First one is hackers are burglars. Everyone who had this model talked about breaking into your computer. Almost always they would use the phrase breaking into, the same way you talk about a burglar breaking into your house. This was really interesting. They talked about how these hackers, once they broke in, they would start rooting around looking for personal or financial information on your computer. They talked about making a digital snapshot of your computer to look for information, about how it's like rummaging around your attic looking for something of value. And then in this model, the hackers are burglars, one of the things that was really interesting is people felt that these burglars chose targets opportunistically. So you walk around the neighborhood, you notice that house is the one that always has the lights off all night, they must be on vacation, I'll go rob them. Things like that. So targets are chosen very opportunistically. Anyone can be a target if you just aren't careful. A closely related one is that hackers target big fish. It's basically the same idea as the burglar model as what people do. Hackers break into computers, look around for financial information. The biggest difference is that these people think that hackers only target rich and important people. So I would never be a target because I'm not rich or I'm not important. The interesting thing that I found is everyone that I talked to who had this model said that I'm not a target, regardless of how rich or important they actually were. And for some reason, people who had this model also felt that these hackers that were intentionally targeting rich and important people were likely to be part of a professional organized crime, as opposed to the burglars, which are more amateur criminals. Again, we can look at some of the standard security advice. Use security software like firewalls. Keep patches up to date. That one was really different between these two models that I just talked about. People who saw hackers as burglars felt that patching your computer really important because hackers targeted people opportunistically. So if you didn't have your computer patched, then you were likely to be a target. People who thought hackers only targeted big fish thought patching was completely irrelevant and unuseful and probably annoying and damaging. And because of that, they didn't keep their patches up to date. If I'm never going to be a target, why would I worry about how secure my computer is? So there's a couple of lessons that I drove from talking to these people and listening to them. Number one, home computer users, they seem to make decisions based on the threats that they think they face. They have this idea of a virus. They have this idea of a hacker. And they make their security decisions based on that. And the fact that expert advice comes from experts doesn't seem to weigh in that much. The important thing is what they think it'll do to the threats that they see. So everyone knows you've got to keep your password secure, but if they think that they're not going to be targeted because they're not rich or important enough, then they won't care about that, and they will ignore that security advice, despite the fact that it comes from experts. These threats, even if they're incorrect, can sometimes induce good behaviors. So this one, I think, is a really interesting lesson for this. That I'll use a quote from another person who studied these kind of models. Technical experts, like most of the people in this room, will tend to evaluate these models by asking whether they are correct. How correct are these models? Not by asking how well does it fulfill the needs of the people. But it's this latter criterion, how well does it work for them in protecting them, that we should base our decisions on. So we need to think about to what extent can we do these models actually encourage correct behaviors rather than worry about how accurate or how correct these models are. Thank you.
What does a neuroscientist do on a security conference? I think when people think about security, they have certain desires. One of them is to reduce the risk in the outside world, or at least to manage the risk. So risk seems to be one of the key parameters underlying our desire for security. We have been working in the reward system for several years, and among others, found some signals in the brain that reflect the risk in this case in rewards, in the environment. So when we talk about these brain structures, when we talk about the brain structures that are involved in reward, these are the ones that are labeled with these green arrows. And some of them are involved in the detection and the processing of risk. And in particular, I'd like to talk today about the prefrontal cortex and the orbitofrontal cortex. The orbitofrontal cortex is right above our eyes, and the prefrontal cortex is just a little bit higher. I'll talk about human imaging experiments, in which we are able to look at the blood flow that is generated by the synaptic activity in the neurons in these areas. We adhere to a definition of risk that is maybe not exactly what we feel in the standard daily world. First, we don't think that risk is only limited to negative, to aversive events. Risk is just the uncertainty that comes out of known probability distributions. If the probability distributions are only partly known, we call that ambiguity. This is the definition we take from economics. The second thing is we make a difference between the risk as an aversive event or the risk per se. Many people say, well, there's a risk of 90% that you're going to lose this game. For us, this is not a risk. For us, this is just a value, in this case, a very low value or a very high aversive value. The risk is something else. The risk is not just the probability. The probability increases simply the value. The risk is the, by definition, for example, the variance or the standard deviation that of a probability distribution. It could also be the entropy that is directly simply related, at least in a Gaussian distribution. Also, the other moments of probability distributions like skewness and kurtosis could be counted as risk. So we follow these definitions of probability theory, the first moment being the expected value, which is not risk, even if there's a high probability of losing something, and the second moment, the variance, is the risk. So we're going to talk about this one here. The one funny thing is, when one just looks first, maybe first at the probabilities, that people have a tendency to misperceive probabilities. In the weeks and months following the September 11 attacks, which killed 3,000 people out of 300 million, which is about 1/100th of 1 per mil, more than half of every single population group of both sexes in the US claimed that they were very, very much in danger of a terrorist attack, with the exception of males between the age of 25 and 35. That's at least something positive for the hormone, for the testosterone. So when we talk of risk, of probability distortions, we don't go that far. We don't have those massive events which enhance the probabilities by factors of thousands and millions. But we just have subjects choose or judge or give pleasantness ratings between different rewards. And what we find is that in compliance with everybody in economics, that with low probabilities, informed probabilities produce a distortion towards the positive. Small objective probabilities are perceived as slightly higher subjective probabilities, and then this often follows this inverted S function of these blue lines that we see here. The red dotted line would be the objective perception. And then some people have a so-called inverted probability distortion. That means we don't perceive subjectively often the probability the way they are. We have a subjective probability perception, and the question is that in one way or another represented in the brain? And the answer, as you can imagine, is yes. In the prefrontal cortex, we see that signals for reward probabilities increase. This is after we have checked that in the behavior with pleasantness ratings. Subjects that have an overweighting of low probabilities and underweighting of high probabilities, the typical thing that you see in the population with informed probabilities, show this in their brain responses to probabilistic rewards, this inverted S function. And the stronger the S function is inverted, is in this form here, the stronger is their brain signal. The few subjects that show the inverted S function in another brain area show a probabilistic reward value signal that is also that follows the standard S. And then these subjects, with their particular high gamma, according to this gamma function, their brain activity is particularly high. So what I'm saying is that these subjective probability distortions are based on brain processes for probabilities that are as well distorted. I'm not saying this is born in. This could be very well acquired through life experience. It's definitely situational dependent, but it is there. It's in the brain. So this is about the value or the value of inherent in probabilities. Now let's talk about risk. What we wanted is an inverted U function in which the risk is highest at a probability of 0.5, and then the risk goes down with the higher probabilities and with the lower probabilities. So just to make this distinction clear again, with a high probability, with a low probability of getting a reward, the risk is actually pretty minimal because we're pretty much certain that we're not going to get the reward. That's my standard explanation. So when we have a particular brain activity in this brain area here, we can correlate that activity with a variance, that is basically with the inverted U function if we plot it as a function of probability, or we can plot it directly with the increase in probability with the expected value. And we see that in this area, there's a pretty good correlation with the variance, with the risk, and not with the value. This is a brain area that codes the risk in environmental events, in this case, in rewards. So then different people have different risk attitudes. Typically, if I would ask you, this is, let's say, 200 pennies, and this is 400 pennies, yet you get with a probability of 0.5, which one do you prefer? I would think that probably half of in the auditorium would in fact prefer the safe and the other one the risky. If I would tell you this is actually 2 million pounds for safe or 4 million pounds with a probability of 0.5, that means half the time you would get, or you have a 50% chance to get 4 million, or you have a 50% chance to get absolutely nothing, I think people would probably, almost everybody would be on this side here, because if you miss this and you get absolutely nothing, you wouldn't sleep anymore having missed these $2 million. So people have different risk attitudes, even depending on the level of the amount of outcome. And we can, of course, measure this. We can present subjects 5 times, 10 times, 20 times with these choices, and the amount of times, number of times they choose safe or they choose risky, we can, from that we can determine their risk attitude. So somebody who chooses primarily the risky outcome would, in this particular situation, with these particular amounts, be risk-seeking, and a person that chooses a safe outcome would be risk-avoiding. And then the question is, if you have a risk signal in the brain, does that in any way reflect this risk attitude? And the answer is, as you can imagine, yes. We find an area, this is the lateral orbital frontal cortex, this is the view of the brain, let's say from behind, you're looking on the right-hand side here, the eyes would be just below here and a little bit more forward. And we see that with the increasing degree of risk aversion, we see a higher risk signal. This is a signal that's particularly prominent in people that hate risk. This is something like a warning signal to those people that are reluctant to engage in risky behavior, and that warning signal would in one way or another try to control your behavior. We understand that the frontal cortex, including the orbital frontal cortex, is a structure that on the basis of cognitive representations is involved in controlling your behavior. Of course, with all respect to the peripheral inputs and to the adaptive coding, which is maybe not top-down, we definitely understand that the prefrontal cortex has such a top-down controlling function. The other thing that we see is, in another part, in the medial prefrontal cortex, a signal that is particularly high in the people that are risk-seekers. These are the strong risk-avoiders. These are the strong risk-seekers. This is a signal that would drive the gambler to gamble, if that signal would ever go to the output, if that cortical structure would not inhibit the behavior, but kind of favor or drive the subject towards these risky outputs. Now, of course, we could imagine that some people have a stronger activity here, have a stronger orbital frontal cortex in this area, more function, and other people have more here. And you could imagine that this would make a person to have a risk avoidance profile, and that would make a person to have a risk-seeking profile, to make a gambler out of this. And there are currently genetic studies with polymorphisms underway, not in our laboratory, that try to find these things. And in fact, it seems to be that this comes out, there are genetic variances that might explain why some people are in more situations risk-seekers and some people are more situations risk-avoiders. Now, if you look very closely, what it actually means to be a risk avoider is not just the perception of risk as being higher or lower, but it's actually that we value risky outcomes less strongly. So if you have a choice between two outcomes, one is safe and one is risky, and the mean is the same, and you choose the safe outcome, that means that actually the risk reduces the value of the risky outcome. So when we go back to value systems in the brain, we would imagine that a risky outcome, depending on the risk attitude of the person, would change the value signal. A risk avoider would have a value signal that is lower for risky outcomes compared to safe outcomes, and the risk seeker would have a higher value signal with risky outcomes compared to safe outcomes. This can be easily graphically shown in economic utility theory, and I just show some examples how that happens. Out of time? Okay. This is a confirmatory. Two voices competing the same data. This is just a value signal that is higher with a higher value and with a risk. This signal breaks down. This is in risk avoiders and in risk seekers. This is a value signal that is higher for higher value compared to lower value, and that signal is increased with the in a risk seeker. The risk seeker shows a higher value signal in a risky situation. All right? Thank you very much.
Don't worry, I'll just carry on. We haven't got very much time. I can just use it as a guide to me. Don't need to worry about too much of the title. So I'm a social psychologist interested in groups and violence, but I'm actually going to start with an insight from an eminent primatologist and ethologist, Franz Duval, who points out that actually, while we know quite a lot about why humans and animals are aggressive, we know much less about how that aggression ends up in violence, and also when that violence begins, how it's brought under control. It turns out that the link between aggression and violence isn't particularly straightforward. Military historians, military psychologists have shown that you can give a soldier training, motive, and opportunity. You can put a gun in their hand, put them in a situation where they can shoot somebody, and soldiers are incredibly bad at doing it. There's lots and lots of evidence which shows that between 15 and 30% of people trained up in those kinds of environments will actually shoot and kill someone. There's lots of avoidance behavior, shooting over the top, putting their guns down, not being prepared to get involved. It turns out, actually, that violence is much harder than we think. It's hard rather than easy. And one of the reasons for this might be something to do with the history of where we experience violence. Most violence happens between people who have experience of knowing each other and also experience of future interactions. It's in family groups, in community groups. And when violence happens in those groups, it's incredibly maladaptive. It actually causes all sorts of problems. So in a way, we are kind of motivated to try and avoid these kinds of things. And Duval calls this natural conflict resolution. Let's see if I can see anything when I go next. Okay. But most of this research on the idea about natural conflict resolution concentrates on the individuals involved, the perpetrator and the victim, if you like. And yet we know that most violence occurs in the context of an audience. Either explicitly people watch these kinds of things going on, or implicitly they know that somebody, there's child abuse happening or there's spousal abuse in a house and so on. And so I'm interested as a social psychologist in what we can say about how the wider community, third parties, the social group, what kind of impact that might have on ideas of conflict resolution, the role that the group can play in bringing these things under control. You'd expect social psychologists to be able to say something about that, but it turns out, actually, that psychology is rather silent, or at least the story we tell is one of the negative impact of the collective. So we've already heard today lots of stories about peer group pressure, the fact that we have mob violence, mass hysteria. Everywhere you go, it seems from social psychology that groups have a negative impact on individual psychological functioning. They make us do things we probably oughtn't to do. And I think, actually, that might be a rather problematic way of approaching this kind of story. Particularly when it comes to violence, we tend to be rather negative about the role that the group plays, partly because we never actually study violence directly. And as Dave Grossman says, he's a military historian, rather disparaging about violence researchers, we inhabit a world of virgins studying sex. What he really means is, most folk have never actually gone out and killed anyone, so I happily hold up my hand for my virginal status. You can all sleep safely in your beds this evening. But I have tried to find another way of looking at real-life violence, rather than laboratory studies or some kind of simulated notion of this kind of stuff. And I spoke about this a bit last year. What I've actually done is collected a corpus together of violence involved in street fighting. Those of you who come from abroad will probably know that Britain has a reputation of kind of drinking and fighting culture. It's one of the moral panics that we suffer from. And I've tried to see if I can look at, this is a source of data, but looking at how third parties may or may not be involved in the informal regulation of this kind of violence. I would tell you about the amount of data that I've got, but trust me, I spoke about this last year, we've got lots and lots of data, and what we do, the data looks like this, and hopefully I can show it to you, just so you get a flavour for what it looks like. You can kind of see it. This is pixelated and also cropped, unfortunately. It's much clearer when we analyse it. We've got 42 of these kinds of clips, half of which approximately end badly in violence, and half are resolved by the people who were there. You can probably see these two guys here, the source of the conflict. All I really want you to look at is the amount and the kind of flow and informal coordination of attempts to intervene and prevent these two guys from actually ending up in something rather serious. And what we do is, frame by frame, go through this corpus of data, looking at the group size, how many people there are, the gender composition, the kinds of acts they're engaged in, whether they're escalating these kinds of things, or there you see some kind of conciliation, putting your hands between people, trying to separate them out, So we end up with lots and lots of behavioral sequences of perpetrator or protagonist and target and third parties, multiple third parties, all involved in attempting to bring, here comes another attempt to de-escalate. Now the story you normally get about these kinds of group activities is that essentially there's alcohol involved, there are lots of other people around, the opportunity for violence should be there. But in fact, what our data shows is that people are spending most of their time trying to do the right thing. They're trying to bring this kind of thing under control. Now, of course, they're not always successful. And so what we've been interested in trying to do is see whether we can predict from the patterns of third-party involvement, whether we can show what kinds of collective third-party intervention predict non-terminal outcomes, non-violent outcomes, and ones which do. How much do you put time? I wasn't going to go to the end of the clip, but I have got time, I think. Partly because some of you may not have seen this before. What you'll see now, eventually you'll see, actually, the group begin to melt away. There's still lots and lots of attempts to de-escalate, both amongst the target, the protagonists, as well as amongst the bystanders themselves. And in this one, a punch does get thrown, and you've been watching it, I hope, rather than listening to me. And so now you get a chance to see whether your guess about who throws the punch is going to be right. Notice also how the crowd, if you like, which was around, has melted away. There's less and less folk there who are involved in trying to stop these things. Maybe they've just become tired of the failed attempts to do it. And bang, there you go. I don't know if you picked him as your puncher. He wasn't one of our original protagonists.
Oh.
About a third of instances end up... And now you get a lot of shirts taking off. We have a lot of this. Not quite sure what's happening or why. Lots of different kinds of theories. And I want you to notice how incompetent the violence actually is until the last bit. It's one punch. Humans are actually really bad at fighting most of the time. Okay, so what emerges from analysis of this kind of data is that as, I suppose counterintuitively, or at least traditional social psychology wouldn't predict this, as the group size increases, you actually get more de-escalation, more pro-social activity, if you like, than escalatory stuff. Essentially, the amount of escalation, if you do kind of a different score, where you take away the amount of de-escalation, the amount of escalation, essentially more conciliation than aggression is being contributed as groups get bigger, which is not what we would have expected. Now, if you could see this, I'd probably have to explain it to you, so it's probably a blessing that it isn't there. What we then did was to try to see whether, given there is this lot of de-escalation coming in, is there some kinds of de-escalation which are more likely to predict successful outcomes? What you see on the end here is every time the perpetrator does something aggressive, what follows from that? We look at the next act and the sequence and the next act and the sequence and the next act and the sequence. And we take the ones which end in violence from the ones which end or are resolved successfully. And it turns out it doesn't matter what happens immediately after a perpetrator's violent act or the second act in the sequence. What's important is what happens at the third turn in the sequence. There's something about the cumulative accretion of acts which is important here. That's what differentiates. And it's at the third turn in the sequence that you can begin to show which of these patterns is going to end violently versus non-violently. And then we look to see, does it matter who does it? If it's the same person in the context of others, or does it have to be groups? Does it have to be a number of others? And again, what you would see here, if you could see the pattern was, down this end at the bottom, this is when the same three acts, I'm nearly done, are done by the same person. So stop, stop, stop. In the context of others. Does that make it better or worse? Well, in fact, the outcome is like to be violent if it's one person while the others are standing by. It's only at this end where you have three separate acts. These are all combinations of one person, another person, another person. This is when it's three separate people. In other words, three different individuals contributing to the stream is much more likely to make the outcome non-violent than violent. Okay, so what's the take-home message then from this? What I want to persuade you is that third parties, in this kind of groupy sense, can bring natural conflict resolution. They are motivated, in this circumstance at least, to bring these things under control. And it's successful when these things are collective and coordinated. It requires the coordination of the group. And given this is a conference about security, I want to persuade you that this kind of intra-group regulation is about the security of the group. And all the stories I've heard so far this morning are really stories which focus on the security of the individual. And they see the group, the collective, as a threat to that individual security. Those kinds of notions of peer group pressure or malign social influence, which we as individuals have to be guarded against or guard ourselves against. I want to offer you an alternative story. There is a collective, a social way in which security can be organized. And I think Ross wrote in one of his papers, the group, I want to suggest to you that although groups can bring violence, they can bring horrible genocides and that kind of stuff, we shouldn't just let the devil have all the good tunes. We can also use these kinds of group-level psychological processes to promote pro-social behavior.
Is a high-risk situation for many people. But if you look at this properly, this is simply a high loss. That means a high reduction, a strong reduction in value. It's not risk, because with a 90% loss chance, the risk is by itself, the degree of uncertainty is very low. It's pretty certain that you're going to lose it.
So, I just wanted to
so we have to, I mean, we see that in this field always, that you have to take these colloquial definitions a little bit more under an eye and look at it very carefully and have to actually read it sometimes.
Right, because I mean, I wondered, you start with this metric concept of risk, which is much easier to deal with analytically. If that doesn't correspond with people's sort of intuitions, then that might mess up the model. But the other part of the main question is do you have any clue why some people have this inverted distortion and or why people have these two different types of distortions? Is it conditioning? Does it depend on the type of risk we're talking about, natural phenomena versus human threats or anything?
I don't know that, but what I know is that when you experience probability, when you experience events and that are infrequent, then the distortion is exactly the opposite. Usually it's the S. So when you see what's happening, the few occurrences tend to get forgotten, and you underestimate the probabilities of experience outcomes, and you overestimate the probabilities of instructed outcomes. That's in general the idea.
Bruce and in the back.
Yeah. Following on that last question, I have a question about the frontal cortex of the Department of Homeland Security. they cannot be underestimating the risk. God knows how many statisticians they can employ. So they know the numbers. And so it must have something to do with their reward risk system having no reward in it. That they, the value that they seem to attach to one life lost to terrorism is hugely greater than the value that they attach to one life lost in a road accident.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they have the homeland security people have a job to do, right? And they got to reduce by any means an attack, and that's no discussion. That's very clear. I'm not saying that they are having a misperception in probability. The journalists, they may have a misperception of probabilities because whenever something happens, one out of a million dies, big deal. But if 5,000 women die because the mammography is done every 3 years instead of every 2 years, then nobody takes any notice. That's because the journalists are reporting infrequent events which catch attention. So attention is the business of the journalists. So I wouldn't go any farther. We have discussed it with many people, and they always reminded me of the situation that the journalist does his job, the Homeland Security officer does his job. It's not that they have this very general perception. We in the population have to ask ourselves how much of this we take on board. We just believe it the way it is and panic and get complete disorders, or how we take it as a grain of salt.
There's a question for Rick. The folk models are interesting, and it seems like there's always, everyone has some metaphor they're using. So they don't understand the actual risk, they're mapping it on some metaphor. Is there any data on what types of people use what sorts of metaphors, or which ones are more prevalent? And is there any way to figure out who might use what metaphor, or is it just random?
That's a good question. I don't have any data on that right now, unfortunately. My sample is not representative of the larger community. That's something I actually really want to study. Yeah. The first step is actually figuring out what the models are. So I think I actually have a good enough idea of what the models are now that I could collect a larger set of data, like from a survey, and try to figure out some of these correlations and who is using which models and why.
I'm willing to bet there's definite age and culture biases.
I do too. And media exposure. I mean, a lot of these seem to come from the media. There's constant periods in time. 20 years ago, the hacker as mischievous teenager ethos was a lot more prevalent than you see now in the news, so I'm sure that has a huge bias on who thinks who believes what.
Just
Chris Cocking, I'm a social psychologist. Just contribute back to the idea of risk. What, from a social psychology point of view, one would argue the risk is often to do with perception and identification. An interesting thing said, for example, the 7/7 bombings, post-7/7 July bombings, many, many people stopped travelling on tube trains and started cycling. Now, far more people have been killed in cycling accidents since July the 7th than are actually killed in terrorist bombs. And we've looked at data that looked at levels of fear and trauma post-9/11, and the levels often were higher in places 1,000 miles from New York than they actually were in New York. And we'd argue that's because that's the identification, the idea that America as a whole was under attack, and because people identified as Americans, they felt more threatened. And this is a common thing in mass emergencies, that people actually habituate very, very quickly to mass trauma and emergencies, because it's uncertainty and how the risk is perceived that causes problems with it.
The example shows also that risk can be used to manipulate the population.
Absolutely.
And I think we can talk about that at length, but this is definitely a point that has been a concern with, particularly with the previous administration in the U.S.
One over here.
The question for Petra Johansson. Has your research been replicated outside Sweden? The reason why I ask you that, I'm Swedish myself, my name is Brian Hoffman, I'm from London. In my view, basically, the Swedes, it's a very different culture. For example, there's an expression in Sweden, you have basically a clenched fist in your pocket. You don't think that, you don't punch the person in the knees. Is this basically the Swedish culture, or is this replicated more widely?
So I spent 2 years in Japan as well at Tokyo University, so I did replicate some studies in Japan. You could argue that Japanese and Swedish are quite similar in docile and sort of shifting, manipulate them to do things without them saying things against it. But we have also, there's a number of different students that contact me because they have replicated the study and done things in Germany and US and Indonesia. You know? So I think it's, the phenomenon is not just for Swedish people.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Over to Petter as well. Methodologically, what do you claim for this test? Because it seems to me that what you've done is demonstrated that under laboratory conditions, you can pressurize people to conform, and you can trick them. And as to a lot of psychology and sort of experiments. But what does that tell us about human behavior in other contexts? Because a lot of the research carried out in public relations, for example, public opinion shows us that people will tell the interviewer the first thing that comes to their head. And that quite often their remarks are, you know, when you actually analyze, are of little value because they're in a very uncomfortable situation. They want to please the interviewer as well. And I'm just doubtful, from a methodological point of view, what the research tells us about human behavior out there, rather than those sort of special conditions.
Many of the studies we've done have been outside the lab. So the one with the magical questionnaire was actually done on the streets. We asked people, we said, we're from the university, we'd like to ask a few questions on their opinions of. I mean, it's still a constrained situation, of course. But I think a lot of the pressure actually comes from the question why. You're engaged in the conversation, and by asking people why did you do this and why did you think this, me questioning them why, it sort of implies that they should be able to answer. So I would say in any conversation type situation there is some sort of pressure that's not that dissimilar from the lab and sort of a normal situation. Also, we did this with taste of jam and smell of tea in a supermarket setting, all that type of very normal situation in which they should be willing to sort of voice any concern had they had any. So, I mean, you can always question results, how far they were generalized.
Yeah, I mean, to follow up with some of these questions, I was wondering if you found areas where sort of choice blindness applies more or less strongly, and I was wondering if you've ever looked at sort of inverse authority situations, for instance. Where somebody is going back to their teacher or their doctor and switching the results, and because they're obviously in the position of lesser authority and saying, why did you do this, and see if you get the same sorts of results.
I'd love to study it, and then the one we've done with the showing on screen or by hand and comparing. We also have a version when there is an animated agent showing it on a screen, so you get a sort of social interaction as well. And then we try to sort of figure out what's the influence of the person doing it, the medium it's done in, and so forth. And we have done it with several different experimenters, and most of them have been like young students. So it's not me, Dr. Johansson, pressuring them into sort of doing this. When I did the first, you said, well, I'm a bachelor thesis student, and my supervisor said I should present this with photographs rather than on a screen because he had some idea of blah, blah, blah. And you try to sort of, you don't want to pressure them.
Coming back on the issues of risk perception, but also of what I'd call lay explanations, folk accounts. Has anyone looked at the intervening effect of the media on this? I'm not familiar with it in terms of risk, but I know about it in terms of economic trends, that people's behavior in relation to inflation and their perceptions of inflation, for example, are affected much more strongly by what the media is currently reporting about inflation than the inflation they are themselves actually experiencing in the purchases they make. So thinking about, somebody was showing us the sort of Google versus CDC data on flu, could one track risk perception against media stories about risk? And indeed, lay explanations of viruses against media accounts of viruses in comparison with the experienced reality of the people?
Yes, is the answer to that. Mary Lockerkin touched on it again. There's been a number of studies, for example, looking at the birth control pill we had in the UK some 10, 15 years ago. We had massive so-called media amplification, worked by Kaskisen et al., 1988, which showed basically because
the story in the media show said that there's a risk of increase in ovarian cancer, but, you know, 100% increase, well, actual cases only like 1 to 2 per million. Like, what happened then basically is that women in this country stopped taking the birth control pill. We had basically unwanted children, and we basically had higher levels of abortions. And in actual fact, abortion levels have never gone back to prior decades, even to this day. I can give you some data on that email.
Thanks. And my question was for Ken, so I'm wondering about the way in which you describe the best sort of secure systems as decentralized systems. But in the human world, as opposed to the animal kingdom, we've got this public accountability that's driven through the media. And it's very difficult in a decentralized system when you're called to account to explain that you've devolved responsibility to local agencies. You know, you've got to have the policy with the drive the policy through. And I just wonder if you've got any thoughts about the way that you could reconcile.
I think we in our work focused on this particular issue because the lesson from nature is decentralized. We were being descriptive and the analysis, if you look back and both collectively and for individuals, this decentralization is a feature of success. And by the way, Darwin, he never said it's survival of the fittest, it's success, it's about reproductive success. And I think if you saw my FEMA example in the inside Department of Homeland Security, we're giving a warning to say you have to move towards decentralization. Another example is another product of 9/11 was appointing a director of national intelligence who was supposed to be superimposed on the top of separate intelligence agencies in the United States, like the NSA, National Security Agency, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. The perception was that they weren't sharing information, so the solution is to centralize it and push it through one place. Unfortunately, that's a very narrow funnel, and it won't work, as we know. Admiral Dennis Blair has just resigned because it doesn't work. And it won't work properly. And a meeting we had this past week, I think that the reality is that organizations adapt to overcome over-centralization. We had a lovely presentation from a Marine captain about Afghanistan. They adapted the company organization at the company level without reference upwards, changing the ranks, changing the inside structure, and they shared that laterally with other companies, and eventually this has influenced the top. So you can look at a number of cases where, despite centralization, the organization, in order to be successful, has to adapt, they're forced to adapt. And that's nature, adaptation is force. But I think it's up to the scientific community to help the top policymakers to be able to explain things like they cannot stand up and say that we're going to eliminate the risk of whatever it might be, terrorism or whatever.
The last question here. Two comments about the role of the media. I published a paper with Roger Caspersen, who was just mentioned, on what we call the social amplification of risk. And we did this almost 2 decades ago. And we've done it more recently, too. It was a very, very strong positive correlation between perceived risk and media coverage. Most recently, some of my students tracked the number of articles in the Wall Street Journal and content since the financial crisis. We went back to July of 2008 before it was really hit mainstream media and followed for about 15 months. And then I and Paul Slovic and another colleague tracked public reaction to the financial crisis. And it's a mirror of each other. And so it's very strong. But my second comment is to Wolfram. Even with media coverage, when we look at external data, there's something called the Cass-Sunstein called probability neglect. And it's very consistent, probability neglect. And you know, Cass-Sunstein is currently in the Obama administration as a lawyer. But he's done some very interesting work on this phenomenon, which I want to look at. But experimentation, people are still, apart from media coverage, very sensitive to low probability events. And we think it might be that there's a long evolutionary history. They may be more diagnostic of threat.
And in experiments, people will pay more money to reduce the probability of an adverse event to collapse to zero, for example, insurance and so forth. So it's largely media coverage, but it's not completely. There's something inherent in the human psyche.
All right, I think that's about all we have time for. So I'd like to thank all of the presenters.